This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us. The Eagles play their fourth game this Sunday, and the Flyers begin their regular season next week. For many Philadelphians, that means hope and anticipation that this year will be different, that Philadelphia will prove that its sports clubs are not cursed and are truly capable of bringing home a championship, delivering the glory to their home city and its long-suffering fans. What is it about the Philadelphia sports fan that they can endure this hope and inevitable disappointment season after season? Author and journalist Joe Queenan filled us in on his struggles as a lifelong Philadelphia sports fan when he joined us to discuss his book, True Believers. Let's take a listen.
So you blame your father for your love-hate of Philadelphia teams?
I think that when I was growing up in the 50s and the 60s, the idea of rooting for a team from another city was just inconceivable. Because for one thing, Philadelphians think of themselves in terms of their neighborhoods. My mother always prides herself on the fact that no matter how desperate our financial situation got, we didn't have to move to South Philly because she's from North Philly. And I'm sure people from South Philly feel the same way. People grew up thinking in terms of their churches, their neighborhoods, their communities, the part of the city. So the idea that you would support anybody but the local teams was just inconceivable. And that has just gone straight through my life. But what's been interesting to me is to see the way my children have done with it. Because my son was born in New York, so he could have rooted for the Yankees, but he made what I thought was the right decision, which is to support the teams that your father supports, to the point where he wants to come to school in Philadelphia. He wants to go to college in Philadelphia. But on the other hand, he could have rooted for the Yankees and made his life a whole lot easier.
So you did a good job as a dad, right?
Well, we'll have to see at the end of his life what he thinks. I think that if he'd become a Yankees fan, his life would have been easier, but it would have probably been considerably less interesting.
How would you describe, then, the psychology, not just of a sports fan, but a sports fan that is so obsessed with losing teams, or teams that get close to a championship and then they blow it?
Well, I think that people probably think that there is some kind of curse. The thing is that in some cities, there's a curse over a franchise. In Philadelphia, there's a curse over the city because the Cubs haven't won since 1908. But the Bulls won six championships, so I don't really feel sorry for Cubs fans. The Red Sox is an interesting case because in Boston, the Celtics won 16 championships, but the people up there don't seem to care that much about it because it's a very racist town, and basketball is the third sport, especially now that Jordan's retired. It's really receded. It's not in a class with baseball or football. But in Philadelphia, all four teams what's really hard right now is that in Philadelphia, all four teams are contending teams.
You have a funny description of a turtle that you have near your radio that you listen to during some important games of Philadelphia teams. Which reminds me of the kind of superstition that people have about sports, not just the people that listen, like yourself, but the players as well, that they have lucky shirts and lucky pins and lucky hats and socks.
Yeah, Shoeless Joe Jackson used to have some thing about picking things up and putting them in his back pocket before games. Right. A lot of good that did him. and that's one of the things that I find so interesting about superstitions is that for 20 years I've been like turning down the sound. I've watched the games on a special television in a special room with special people. It hasn't done any good whatsoever. I mean, on a like play-to-play basis, sometimes it's worked. It's worked for individual games, but it certainly hasn't worked in the sense of delivering a championship. And yet there's some part about it that makes you keep doing it.
Well, you even went to a psychiatrist to try to deal with this obsession you have with losing teams. And because even though the psychiatrist didn't really help you, while you were at the psychiatrist, these Philadelphia teams were doing pretty well, so you kept going, just
right,
thinking the fact that you went to the psychiatrist had something to do with the fact that they were having victories on the field.
Yeah, because talking to the psychiatrist was not productive. I basically went to him and said, I need... I need help. I think that rooting for my teams is an addiction like alcohol or smoking or, you know, snorting cocaine. Maybe you could help me. And he immediately said, tell me about your father. Because psychotherapists only know how to do two things, blame everything on your father or blame everything on your mother. So if you go to a shrink, pretend that your parents are already dead, force them to do some work. They'll say it was your uncle or your, you know, something. But it's such a kind of bogus profession. Psychotherapy was the great fraud of the 20th century. In any case, he. I remember one time coming in, and it was a Monday, and I was feeling really bad. And he said to me, how was your weekend? I said, it was horrible. The 76ers blew an 18-point lead to the Pacers, and the Flyers got creamed by the Sabres. He says, you know, I really get sick of you talking about these things as if they really mattered. I said, well, why don't you tell me about something that would matter to you, and then you would understand what I'm feeling. And he said, well, I could get excited about the destruction of the rainforest. I said, how could you compare the destruction of the rainforest to my team losing by 18 points? I mean, what kind of priorities do you have there? What, did we ruin a few wetlands? You know, did we endanger the habitat of the snow puma? I mean, get serious. But then I couldn't stop going to him because the Sixers got to the finals. And I was in Philadelphia. I had a meet appointment with him. The day that I was supposed to see him was the day that the Sixers were playing Game 3 against the Lakers. I didn't go to one of my appointment. I came down here. The Sixers lost the next three games.
I
will go to my grave believing that I jinxed them by stopping going to see my shrink.
This sentence caught my eye. Without sports, you write, the average man would have no emotional life.
Yes. And I truly and truly, truly, truly believe that. I think that my wife has always understood that if the only time she's ever going to see me really excited about something is if it involves sports, then she's willing to deal with that. And I find that it's very interesting in that there's a positive side to that, too, in that it's good that you can be that excited about something that you're not going to succeed at, because most of the time men get excited about things that involve money. They have a big car, they have a big house, they have a great job.
If they're lucky,
but I don't get excited about things like that. Because there's a kind of logic to your career. It goes in a certain direction because of certain things that happen. Whereas with sports, there's always this unexpected element. There's always this, you know, total surprise. Tampa Bay hasn't won a game when the temperature was less than 25 in 100,000 years. They come to Philadelphia and win the last game in Veterans Stadium.
There you go.
So for them, that was fun. But that's the thing is that at least with sports, there isn't a script. And with everything else in life, there is a script.
And 1964, a year you call annus horribilis.
Yes, definitely.
Nothing worse.
No, right? It was the worst. In fact, that's one of the things that I'm happy about is that if the worst thing that ever happens to you in your life happens when you're a kid, it's probably a good thing. For a lot of people, the worst thing that ever happens to them in their life is they meet their parents, which is so, you know, get it out of the way early. But no, 1964 was one of those things. Another thing that I thought about was 1964 was the year of the Philadelphia race riots. And Connie Mack Stadium was located right in the center of, you know, where the race riots were taking place. And there was just a sense that if that team had won, everything would have been great. You know, everything would have been, maybe Rizzo wouldn't have been such a nasty, you know, mayor. Maybe things, but there was definitely a sense in this particular place that was this magical time. And then it was taken away in the most horrible and ignominious way because they became the biggest chokers in the history of any sport.
Now I understand the title of your book, True Believers, the tragic inner life of sports fans. Let me just read a paragraph, and this is a very poignant story. A friend tells a story about taking his 10-year-old son to a Jets game. The game was being played during a driving rain on a freezing cold day, and the Jets lost by 20 points to a team they were supposed to beat. As they headed towards the exits, the boy looked up with tears in his eyes and asked, Dad, why are we Jets fans?
Yeah.
It's one of those great philosophical questions that parents get.
It really is. And it's very interesting because what a lot of people forget in places like Philadelphia, looking at New York, is that In New York, there are really two sets of fans. There's the fans who root for the Yankees, who usually also root for the Giants. And there's the fans who root for the Jets, who also root for the Mets. If you root for the Jets, the Mets, the Rangers, and the Knicks, you might as well be in Philadelphia. Because the Rangers are probably, I would say, after the Phillies, the least successful franchise in the history of professional sports. The Knicks have always been mediocre. They've never had a great team in their entire history, even the teams that won the championship. The Mets are like the Phillies. They're not real. Like, look at this year. They have a $115 million team. They're in last place. And the Jets, of course, are pathetic. So people like that who root for the Jets, I mean, they are – those people really, really are true believers. They are – you see them out there at the end of the season in their horrible old – yellow raincoats, chain smoking, just shaking their heads because once again the Jets have blown a season. And I really think rooting for the Jets is harder than rooting for the Eagles.
But isn't it, if it's not about the players who go from team to team, it's about the sports fans with each other. And it's about, as you said, the and this is a semi-serious question, but it's about the relationship that you have that you can talk about all this stuff.
It's also about the idea of, are you going to, is there anything in your life that you're going to stick to your entire life? Are you going to like say, this is what I believe in? Because then you get people who are like, well, first they're a Democrat, then they're a Republican. First they're with the U.S., then they're with the Taliban. You know, I mean, that's the thing that I think is so great about sports This is what I believe in. This is what my father taught me. This is what I've stuck to my entire life. And once that kind of fades, well, then there's just this kind of like vagueness about everything. It's like, well, I'm in Washington. I might as well root for the Redskins. Well, I'm in Afghanistan. I might as well root for the Taliban. So the next thing you know, you got John Walker Lind.
Actually, can I have you read just that last paragraph of the book? Because I think it summarizes somewhat what we've been talking about.
This is about, I was in Chicago a couple of years ago, between the fifth or sixth innings, I guess, I went out to get a hot dog, and I walked up to a man who obviously was about 75 and had been rooting for the Cubs and had never seen them win in his entire life. And I said, what's it like to root for a team that hasn't won a World Series your entire life? He could have taken it as a taunt. He could have dismissed me as a typical wise-ass New Yorker or a thoughtless, tactless tourist or just another front-runner or even a first-class jerk. Backed into a corner, he could have trotted out the usual Chi-Town spiel about the mythical allure of Wrigley, about how every game was a movable feast, a celebration of our beloved national pastime. You know, the Ken Burns routine. But he didn't. He scooped up his hot dog and beer and started to vamoose. Then he looked back, smiled, and spoke with the peerless eloquence of the common man. Well, they've been playing pretty well lately, he said. I think the inning's starting.
So that's the
that's the end of the book.
Well, that is the end of the book, but that's the optimism that underlays all this shame as we've been hearing about today, and pessimism and worry and superstition.
The darkest hour is just before the dawn. Keep on going.
That was my 2003 interview with author and journalist Joe Queenan, who had joined me to discuss his book True Believers, The Tragic Inner Life of Sports Fans. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my interview with actress Patti LuPone. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Tony Award-winning actress Patti LuPone has long been known as a powerful singer-performer in musicals, most notably the first to tackle the role of Eva Perón in Evita in 1979. But, as many artists do, she recently decided to work outside her comfort zone. She has taken an on-screen gig as the newest regular on the British historical drama Penny Dreadful, following a stint on the hit series American Horror Story. She joined me in the studio years ago to discuss her career and the cutthroat nature of working on Broadway when she was in town to promote her one-woman show, Matters of the Heart. Let's listen. What do you look for in a love song?
I don't know, something complicated, something unusual, something that, pricks up my ears, basically.
You look for words, you look for music. I think, watching you perform.
I think that's where I start, actually. People say, how do you work on a song? And I think I start from the lyrics, if I can make sense of the story. And then if the story and the music if there's a marriage between the note and the lyric, then it's a great mm-hmm. song.
Are there a lot of good love songs being written today, would you say?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not plugged in as completely as some other singers might be plugged in with the new songwriters. But we discovered John Buchino purely by accident. Mm-hmm. And he has phenomenal love songs. They are contemporary, complicated, and pretty odd takes on contemporary love.
How'd you find him?
Well, a year earlier, I had gotten a letter from a minister and a tape of John Buchino's. They wanted me to sing something at a celebration that they do every year, and I just put it on my piano, and it sat there for a year. And then it was summertime, and I had the summer free, so I went up to the Lazy Lay Pool. That's the name of our ranch, Lazy Lay Ranch.
You're a chicken farmer,
yes,
right?
Yes, and it's called the Lazy Lay because the chickens one summer, when they should have been producing eggs, were just eating all the food. So my husband named it the Lazy Lay. So I went up there and I started to listen to all of these tapes that had accumulated, and I put on John Buchino. I read the letter and I went, oh my God, this was a year ago, and when the guy was asking me to perform. And I put on John Buchino's tapes and could not take them off. Then I wrote a letter to the minister apologizing for not getting in touch with him sooner than this, and I wrote or called John Buchino and said, I am deeply, deeply sorry. However, I want to talk to you because your music is incredible. And if I could have, it would have been an entire night of John Buchino.
But you like his, they're complicated,
they're not happy.
Uh-huh.
It's not that love should be depressing, but there is always, there's sort of an intellectual bent to these songs. It's not just goo.
Well, I think what's great about love songs is you get to sing about everything when you sing a love song. Mm-hmm. Because of where it takes you and all the emotions and experiences associated with a love song or mm-hmm. different love songs.
Yeah, he writes very interesting stuff. There's one, Sweet Dreams, that I wanted to do about two different people who meet on a bus. She's left her family and he's a drifter, whatever, and they fall in love and they both go to L.A. And then she ends up, I think, working in a bar as a whatever, and he ends up the boyfriend of a rich mogul.
Wow.
But it's sweet. It's about, you know, how that all unfolded. He's a very interesting songwriter.
It's interesting when you're so used to hearing a song as a member of the audience, when someone does it differently. First, you know, you don't know how to enter the song because it's not the one that's rattling around in your head. But then when you do, you really hear it differently. All of a sudden, the words that had flown by before become more prominent. I wonder, even as you sing it, is that the sort of process of owning it as a singer?
So. I think so, yeah. Again, it's like just doing it all
doing
over
it
and
right.
over again.
God, that seems so unglamorous.
I know.
It?
My God, who said show business was glamorous? They're crazy. No, it's hard, diligent work.
Yeah.
No, it's repetition, 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 repetition. And eventually, in my particular case, something sinks in.
But is it sort of an aha, or is it just sort of?
It's an aha.
It's like all of a sudden it's literally that moment you think.
And I'll tell you something else. And this at least it's true for me. I have discovered over the years that I can only do so much work, and then the audience comes in and does the rest of it. They will inform the rest of my performance, whether I'm playing a character in a play, a character in a musical, or doing a one-woman show, because ultimately it's for the audience, and I have to be in tune to the audience to know whether I'm reaching them or not.
How can you tell, though? I mean, here.
Oh, you can.
You can.
I mean, if you're in tune to the audience. Right. I mean, if in my case, the audience is the main character of the play, and they are neglected, I have to say, in today's theater.
Why? How?
Oh, well, because you know the whole world is changing, and it's all about how much money you can make. It's less about. Where's our where are our arts today? Where's our creative sensibility today? And so I find that when I go to the theater, I'm generally angry at the actors or the singers or most especially the producers for putting on the schlock and for the actors to allow that you know, people don't care anymore. They don't care. The audience is getting ripped off. I'm sorry.
No. I'm interested in what you're saying, but in terms of the audience playing a part, playing a role in a play, then you can tell what, because there's a certain kind of hush.
Yes, there's a silence that's deafening when they're all listening. I mean, I've had that experience in the theater myself. I think we all go into a theater poised for an accident to happen, which is magic, you know. And when those lights go out, individually and collectively, everybody just takes a theatrical leap.
Yeah, big breath.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And when there's a lot of coughing in the audience, a lot of rustling of paper, a lot of people getting up and down, you don't have them.
So it's that
when
quiet.
The programs are silent, when the people are still in their seats, when there's no unwrapping of candy, and there is that focus on the stage, which you can't help but sense if you're in tune with the audience, then everybody's having the same experience.
Can you make that happen, though, as an actor?
Mm-hmm. You have to.
I mean, that's part of
that
your job, is to quiet the audience.
That is your job. You walk out on stage and you command it. And you basically, in that command, you basically relax the audience. I mean, I've gone on stage going, oh, my God, what's going to happen to that poor actor? Oh, my God. And I'm totally out of the play. Right. I'm worried about that performer. Right. I'm sure you've had that experience.
Oh, sure. You started performing, as a four-year-old?
As a four-year-old,
What were you doing as a four-year-old?
Well, my dad was principal of the local elementary school, and he wanted to start an extracurricular program. And one of the activities was dancing. So, of course, as a four-year-old girl, I was enrolled. And it was the Miss Marguerite Dance Studio. My brother fell in love with my hula costume, so he started dancing. But I remember we were doing a tap dancing recital, and I was in black patent leather tap shoes.
I can see it.
Black leotard, a little black jazz skirt, little capizio black. And I was downstage, right, furiously tapping, and I looked out at the audience and went, hey, they're all smiling at me. I can't get in trouble up here. I can do whatever I want, and they'll still smile at me. And I never looked back.
Really? Now, were you a little kid with a big voice?
Yes. Oh, I always knew my mother used to troop me out when she had guests to do my Marilyn Monroe imitation. Yeah, it started very early.
That's an audience you have to sometimes work over, right? Well, can you do that for us now?
Well, it was Marilyn just Monroe. This, and it was... the whatever I had on would slip down over one shoulder and do the pouty mouth, like in, was it Red River? Wasn't it Red River with Robert Mitchum, where she was doing that strange English accent from the Actors Studio? I don't know, but she was talking. And the lips were doing that weird thing.
Right. So you're a good mimic, I guess, as a kid?
No.
A good actor?
I mean, once it chose me, then I just dove in head first.
You went to Juilliard, did you? And you studied acting there with John
Hoffman? Yes.
What is that?
Well, it was just difficult.
Because he was, demanding, difficult?
Yeah, and the teachers were, and the course was. It was 4 years, and my brother went to the dance division. He said, it's not getting in Juilliard, Patty, that's difficult. It's getting out straight, because they have a tendency to mess with your head. At the time, there were a lot of suicides in the Juilliard school.
Really? This is what, the 60s, 70s?
Late 60s, early 70s. I went from 68 to 72. I don't know. I think it's cushier now because they have dormitories. I mean, first of all, they would audition people from all over the country and all over the world. And in the music department especially, if you were first chair violin in your high school, you had to compete with maybe 30 first chairs for one first chair in the Juilliard Orchestra. So that's phenomenal competition to put on a person
18-year-old, right?
Yeah, that also has to adjust to New York City. I mean, in our particular case, and in the dance division, they're forming ensembles. And I was lucky that I was from Long Island and made several trips into New York City and lived in the city a year before I went to Juilliard. But those people fresh off the farm from Wisconsin had a hard time dealing with 13 hours of brutality at school and then hitting the streets of New York with no money and just the meagerest of apartments to live in. I mean, they had these things up at the old Juilliard was in Harlem, and Reldness Hall was this hideously rat-infested dormitory or apartment complex for students of Columbia or there was another, I think, Manhattan School of Music, whatever. And a lot of the students were there, but it was depressing as you can't believe. I had an apartment. I was sorted. And those of us that were from the East Coast and had experience in New York adjusted a whole lot better than the ones from the Midwest.
How did you, though, I mean, you described it as really a brutal, I guess, indoctrination into acting. How did you survive it? Did you
I don't know.
Go with it? Or, I mean,
I don't know.
Do you still have wounds from it
now?
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
I can't see any of my classmates. Or, you know, it was brutal. I don't think it's as brutal. It was the first year, so they were trying to find their way as well. And what they would do is they'd chop away at your psyche to break you down, to mold the Juilliard actor.
Hmm.
And now Juilliard has dormitories, and it's not as it's not as difficult. But then you see softness in the actors as well.
Interesting. Did you have to unlearn some things then?
No, I'll tell you what, however brutal it was, it was an unbelievably invaluable experience for
really?
Me. And I can go into any situation and go, yeah, well, I've been there already, so this is easy. This is a cakewalk.
How did you get the part of Evita?
Well, I was living with Kevin Klein at the time, and he was doing On the 20th Century, which Hal Prince directed. And he came home and said, Patty, there's a musical that you should audition for. And Paul Gemignani, the musical director, said, Patty, you should audition for this musical. And I got the White Album, which was Julie Covington and I think Colm Wilkinson as Jay. And I listened to the whole album when we still had albums.
Yes.
And I took it off the turntable, alien words to your younger crowd. And I said, yuck, Andrew Lloyd Webber hates women. That was my first reaction. I went, ay, this guy hates women. Then I got 1941, a movie by Steven Spielberg. I know, I went to the Joanna Merlin, who was Hal's casting director, had seen us at Juilliard. So she knew my ability to act. Nobody knew my ability to sing. So I went for the initial audition, and they said, don't do anything. We'll call you back for the final audition. Well, I was in L.A. shooting 1941, and Treat Williams was in it, and Treat Williams decided to take a day off, or whether he was on hold, and left the state. Stephen changed the shooting schedule and wanted Treat, and Treat could not be found, so the whole day was wasted. So the producer said, nobody is allowed to leave the state of California while this movie's being made. And that's when the final audition for Evita was.
Ooh, so did you sneak out of the state?
No, Janet Healy, Stephen's assistant, went over to the producer and basically said, you've got to let her go. I mean, I had such a small part. I said, she said, you have got to let her go. And he came over to me with beady little eyes and pointing fingers and said, if you don't get back here for your day of shooting, your name is Mud in Hollywood. And I went, I don't want to do a Broadway musical. I want a Hollywood career. I got on the plane, and I woke up in my apartment to the blizzard of 78, I think, where everything stopped dead in New York City. I was in summer clothes because I was in California, and I got off at the wrong end of 42nd Street and had to trudge through knee-deep snow to get to the Schubert Theater, where a chorus line was playing, which my brother was in. And there was a white line across the street. I was so mad. I was furious because I also knew that the planes were canceled, and I was screwed. And there was a white line across the street. I went, they must think we have to stand behind that white line. So when it was my turn, my brother was sitting there, and I said, am I going to get on the plane? And he wouldn't speak to me. Hmm? And I went, am I going to get on the plane? So it's my turn to audition, and I walked out on the stage, and I took a giant step in front of the white line and barreled through Rainbow High, Buenos Aires, and Don't Cry for Me, Argentina.
Damn it. Right?
Damn it. Got back to California, which is another funny story. There was no flights taking off that night. The next morning when I woke up, and they don't tell you that if your flight is canceled, you must immediately book another flight. You think that you're going to be honored because you were canceled. Well, no, you're not. And I didn't know that. But Christopher Reeve, who had gone to Juilliard and who was Superman at the time, actually got
me. Flew you on his back,
well,
right?
Well, basically, he got me on the plane.
Really?
He went up to the Stewies and said, Stewies, air flight attendants. And no PC here. Said, you got to get her on the plane. She's making a movie in California. Whoa, this way, Ms. LeBone. And I got on the plane, and I only missed about an hour's worth of work. God. Then I got Evita on the set of 1941 and burst into tears because I had been slated to do a revive a play that I had done with David Mamet called The Woods, and I knew that this was going to not make David happy, and it didn't make me happy, mm-hmm. but I knew that this was the choice I had to mm-hmm. make. So I went into it already with a lot of anxiety.
Right. And I can't avoid a question about Sunset Boulevard and Andrew Lloyd Webber. You had been promised the part in New York.
I had a signed contract.
Exactly. And it was given to Glenn Close. I guess you got some kind of a settlement out of this deal. Does your path ever cross with Andrew Lloyd Webber these days?
Or hopefully never again.
Do you avoid each other as scrupulously as you possibly can?
Oh, yeah.
Why did he do that, do you think?
God, who knows? I mean, there were problems inherent in the piece. Andrew was also the producer. One of my favorite moments before we opened was Andrew pulling the score, the producer pulling the score. Oh, no, the composer pulling the score from the producer. And I'm going, oh, my God, this is insane. He's pulling it from himself. What is he accomplishing? And you shoot the messenger, don't you? I mean, Kevin Anderson, who was my Joe Gillis, also was fired, and very few people know about that. And everyone was affected. It wasn't, I mean, mine was the most public humiliation.
Did it feel like that?
Oh, my God. It was on. It went on for the minute the New York Times review came out, then the minute that Glenn Close opened in L.A., the New York Times actually, you know, put me in the coffin and then nailed it shut. There was how to get Patty off the stage, how to make her quit, basically. I mean, so I would go through things. It was just so deeply, deeply, deeply painful, and was told by everyone to continue performing. The money wasn't worth it, and it was a lot of money, but it just, you know, emotionally wasn't worth it. And major psychological damage was done to myself and to my family.
You feel that to this day?
We're beyond it. I mean, you know, it would be one thing if Sunset Boulevard was playing around the world, but it tanked. So I was vindicated.
That was my 2003 discussion with actress Patti LuPone. The veteran stage performer has just become the newest regular cast member of the British historical drama Penny Dreadful on Showtime. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. And when we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geraldine Brooks. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We turn now to my conversation with author and journalist Geraldine Brooks. She won a Pulitzer Prize for fiction for her novel March, which created a Civil War backstory for the absent father mentioned in Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. She has just published her sixth novel, and it's called The Secret Chord. The Australian-born author joined me in the studio years ago to discuss her approach to writing and her time as a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Let's take a listen. You know, you're not the only journalist to become a novelist. I mean, that seems to happen not a lot, but enough to be noticeable. What do you think that's about?
I have no idea. I never had the aspiration to be a novelist growing up. I thought being a journalist was wildly ambitious enough. I loved my reporting career. I loved every step I took. But the kind of reporting I ended up doing, which was foreign correspondence and usually in chaotic or tragic situations, it just wasn't compatible for me with having a child. And so when I was lucky to be expecting my son, I just realized that I need a new gig here because I don't want to go off on long open-ended assignments in dangerous places anymore. And so I started writing nonfiction and then gradually got up the nerve to try and make that big leap that I was a bit worried I might end up as a wet splat in a crevasse.
It's a big leap, though, isn't it, journalism to fiction?
It is. It definitely is. It's different. But there are some things about being a journalist first that I find very helpful.
Deadlines.
Well, I'd say not so much deadlines because I shouldn't say this too loudly, but publishers are quite slack about deadlines, really. Book publishers, they're used to people missing them. I think it's more about not being precious about the process of writing, not waiting for your aura to be on straight. Because if you do that on a newspaper, you'll get the sack. So you learn to write under almost any circumstances, and some of the circumstances I remember writing in Kurdistan with a pencil in the dark with a candle, you know, because there was absolutely no electricity, no way to use a laptop and all these luxuries that we have come to depend on, with, you know, shelling in the distance and not knowing when you're going to have to make a run for it. Mm. So it's far less dramatic now in my study. But I always remember something that Jimmy Breslin said, which is that writing is like bricklaying. And the words are your bricks, and you put them down one after the other. And some days you'll make a wall that's straight and true. And some days your wall will be just a shocker. Hmm. And you probably have to knock it over the next day. But you just have to go ahead and lay the bricks.
I like that. I mean, I like the image, and I like the message of what he's saying as well. Did you also feel, as a war correspondent or a correspondent that ended up covering a lot of wars and fighting conflict, that your luck was running out?
I definitely felt like you had a limited number of tickets in your ration book. And there was a kind of a self-preservation mechanism that journalists had, so that if anything ever bad happened to anyone, the other journalists would say, oh, that happened because X. And, you know, if somebody was in a hostage situation and they made a run for it and they got shot, the journalist would all say, oh, well, obviously that happened because he made a run for it. But if they got shot because they didn't make a run for it, they'd say, well, that happened because he didn't make a run for it. So there was this kind of, I think it was just trying to reassure yourself mm-hmm. that there was an answer. But often there's no answer whatsoever. And I think that was all brought home most clearly to us when Danny Pearl was so brutally murdered.
Was decapitated in Pakistan. The fact that you could just be doing your job and some horrible thing happened.
Doing your job.
Did you know him, by the way?
I knew him, and he was a really, really wonderful man. And what happened to him would have been tragic even if that were not the case. But he was a spectacular human being. And I think for me, it stopped me ever feeling wistful for that life again mm-hmm. because he was not reckless in any degree. This was something that journalists do day following day. And to think that he could have been betrayed like that was just horrific.
And were you at the Wall Street Journal when he was killed, or had
no,
you?
No, we'd left long since, but right. But we did know him.
And where were you when you, I mean, I guess you learned
it. I was
like
in Australia at the time, and I just, you know, I thought he'd get out of it. You know, I really did. I didn't think that, you know, it would have this brutal and horrible conclusion. So many people in the world were raising their voices to ask for his release. And we've all, I'm afraid, had to harden our hearts, and other terrible things have happened, like the woman who was in Baghdad working for CARE, only doing good for the Iraqi people, that somebody like that could be murdered.
You were actually arrested in Nigeria. What, you were covering Shell Oil
at
the time?
Yeah, Shell was in cahoots with the very brutal regime of Abacha, who was the military dictator at the time. And there was a non-violent, almost Gandhi-esque protest movement by the subsistence farmers who lived in the Delta region where Shell had been operating for 35 years, and there were no schools, no hospitals, no clinics. All the oil wealth had just been exported, and their lands had been desecrated in a way that Shell would never, ever do outside of Africa. Their European operations are impeccable, environmentally sound, and all that good stuff. And it was unbelievable to see this devastation. Anyway, I was... there'd been a massacre of these protesters because Shell had called on the Nigerian military to come in and just shoot them all. And so I went to report that for the Wall Street Journal. And after I'd, you know, gone to the villages and seen the aftermath of obviously something very brutal had happened.
And I'm assuming we're talking about people that have been killed or shot.
I saw people bodies. Who were injured. There were no bodies there, but there were shell casings. Right. And, you know, obviously it had been a very one-sided thing, whatever had happened there. So I went, as you do as a journalist, to the military to get their side of the story. And they handed me straight over to the secret police, who threw me in a lockup in Port Harcourt.
How long were you there?
Oh, only 3 days, as it turned out. I was really lucky. I had made an arrangement to talk to some Irish nuns who worked in this region, and I was going to meet them after Sunday Mass. And when I didn't show up, they wondered why, which was incredible because there are no working phones in this region, and it could have been just that something had come up. But they actually went to the hotel where I was staying, and they sought out the guy who'd been driving me, and he told them that I'd been taken to the police lockup. So they told the Wall Street Journal what had happened, and things were set in motion to get me.
Yeah.
Deported.
got you deported. So yeah. You're persona non grata in Nigeria
Actually, it was funny because the Nigerians aren't very fond of the secret police either. And so when I got to the airport, the immigration official said, I'm not going to deport you. I'm just going to say repatriated. So
oh, interesting.
You can come back if you want to. I said, okay, thanks, but no thanks.
But was that one of those events where you felt like, you know, maybe I'm testing the fates a bit too much or...
It wasn't so much that, but I wasn't sure how long they were going to detain me. And while I was lying on the concrete floor in this nasty little lockup, I thought, gee, you know, Terry Anderson, 7 years in captivity in Lebanon. If they keep me 7 years, I'll be too old to get pregnant. So it was the first time. I mean, I always thought about having a child and a family, but it was the first time I realized that if I didn't do this in my life, I would really regret it. So when I got home, I greeted my husband with more than usual enthusiasm.
And 9 months later, a child was born?
Not quite, but close.
I read, and your husband's a journalist, or was, I guess, a journalist at the time.
Now he's a book writer, too.
And now he's a book writer, too. But I read, I think, one of his descriptions of the two you together, I hope I have this right, where you're climbing into a helicopter or some kind of an airplane, and there's shooting all around. He's absolutely terrified. I think he's even throwing up. You're asleep. You're just snoozing back there while all hell breaks loose around you.
I really love flying.
That's not a good enough description or explanation.
I find turbulence is like, you know, being rocked in a hammock. But no, it was, I in some ways I was very well suited to this job that I fell into by accident. I wasn't somebody who, you know, wanted to be somebody who covered wars, but I found that I was very calm in those situations, which was surprising to me.
Surprising to yourself. I
mean,
does that mean you were intrepid, that you were braver than other people?
No, I don't think of myself that way, but I just think that you never know how you're going to be in that kind of situation. And it just seemed that I had the right chemical makeup to go into some kind of endorphin-induced stupor or something. I don't know. But I didn't, you know, feel particularly... that the bullets were going to find me, or, you know, it's just denial, really.
It works, though, doesn't it?
It worked for long enough, anyway,
yes.
I'd say.
Yes, yes, yes. You grew up in Australia, and you've written a bit about your mother, I guess both your parents, but certainly your mother, who was a journalist.
She was a radio announcer,
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And how she... sounded like sort of made your backyard the whole world.
She was fantastic. She had this wonderful imagination, and she just always wanted to be a mom. And for my sister and me, she just created the most fantastic fantasy world. And, you know, it was I was pretty ill when I was a small child, so I didn't go to school all that regularly, but it didn't matter because I learned more sort of trailing around after her. And we'd have these games where she'd bet me that I couldn't learn Portia's Mercy speech by the end of the day. And
Does that mean you were homeschooled? I mean,
it it meant that even though I was missing a lot of school, I was probably learning more.
Right. And a sickly child? I mean, meaning that you got sick all the time?
Yeah, I for about 5 years, I just got everything that was going, and I used to run these really, you know, quite dangerously high fevers, so I was off school a lot.
Right. And did your sister have the same?
No, she was, you know, she was tough and healthy and well, yeah.
Did you read a lot as a kid?
All the time.
All the time.
Yeah. Loved books.
Which books did you love? I mean, what were some of those books
of
your childhood?
The first book that I couldn't put down was an Enid Blyton adventure story, and it just went on from there. But there are all kinds of... And my dad was great. He loved to read to us, so he would read to us when we were little every night between 7 and 7:30, and he would bring books that were way over our head, but he loved to read them to us and then explain what was going on. So,
and he was a journalist too, right? Or he worked at a newspaper?
He was a proofreader on the Sydney newspaper.
So they both, and your mom worked part-time? Or she
no,
worked?
No. Once my older sister was born, she quit work.
And you had pen pals, yes?
I did. I always was thinking that Australia was the absolute end of the earth at that time. And I wanted to write to people who I thought lived in more exciting places. So I had a pen pal in the U.S. and in France and in the Middle East. I had an Arab and a Jewish pen pal. And I was always projecting on them that they had this fascinating life, when actually our little segment of suburban Sydney was filling up with fascinating people, refugees from conflicts all over the world. So you only really had to talk to the neighbors to get a sense of the wider world.
And how did you get to the U.S.?
I got a scholarship that was made in memory of an Australian correspondent called Greg Shackleton, who was killed in East Timor. And he'd always wanted to go to the Graduate School of Journalism. So I got a scholarship in his name, and I was at Columbia, and I met two very important men there. One was my husband, Tony Horwitz, and we got married, and the other was the recruiter for the Wall Street Journal.
So. Oh, sorry. But did you think, as a little girl reading books, that you wanted to be a journalist, or was that just...
I wanted to be a journalist. I think when I was about 8 or 9 years old, I went in to visit Dad at the newspaper where he worked. And in those days, the presses were right in the building. And when they fired up the press, the whole building vibrated and the air was sort of misty with ink. And it was so exciting. And he reached onto the conveyor and grabbed a newspaper and handed it to me. And it was warm.
Oh, my goodness.
Hot off the presses. And I felt so excited about being the first to know what was going on in my city. And so from that day, I wanted to be part of that.
And do you still feel that today about the news? Or are you
Yeah. I'm a total junkie.
Are you?
Yeah.
You read, you watch, you listen. You did everything. And did you want to be a foreign correspondent? Did you want to cover wars?
No, that wasn't really on my radar. I thought I'd cover the environment and cultural issues and tool around my own backyard. But way leads on to way. And when I was offered the Middle East correspondence job, more or less out of the blue, and I certainly wasn't prepared or qualified for it at the time, the little girl in me that longed for adventures in faraway places immediately said yes before the woman had a chance to say, "Are you out of your mind?"
And was it a good decision? I mean,
it was eventually, but the first year was extremely hard. I didn't know what I was doing there, and I would get the call to go to some place that was breaking out into, you know, violence, and I'd be on the plane with this huge stack of State Department briefing papers doing a crash course in Yemen or Bahrain or the Straits of Hormuz, and, you know, but a year into it, the penny finally dropped that I had this great opportunity there, which was to tell the stories of the news through the women of the region, and nobody was doing that at that time. And once I did that, I was knocking on an open door. Even the women of Hezbollah were so open and welcoming and so delighted to have somebody ask them why they had made the choices they had made, why they believed so fervently in these causes. And so I had some fascinating experiences, everything from going to have tea with Ayatollah Khomeini's widow to having veggie burgers with Queen Noor in the royal palace in Jordan during the Gulf War. So it was that I think was the way I was able to be effective as a journalist.
That was my interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geraldine Brooks from 2008. She has just published her sixth novel called The Secret Chord. And that wraps up this edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.